Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to ad-free episodes, a private Discord server, archives, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. There is perhaps no more misunderstood, purposefully misunderstood job in the country, maybe the world right now, than being a drag queen. It is one of the few performance art forms that, like, politicians feel the need to weigh in on. For some reason, putting on a dress and makeup and going out on stage and lip-syncing to an old Reba McEntire song makes you a predator of some kind. And as beloved and even mainstream as the art form has become, thanks to shows like RuPaul's Drag Race and all of its various spin-offs, it's still viewed, even by a lot of its supporters, as this very narrow type of entertainment. However, there are drag queens and kings out there right now absolutely breaking, destroying the mold, showing us that drag was not only always political, but its artistic merit is so multifaceted. It is so many things. And that's why I am really excited about my guest today. Jinx Monsoon is a two-time RuPaul's Drag Race winner, Broadway breakout star, and soon-to-be villain on the beloved British sci-fi series Doctor Who, which is coming to Disney Plus in 2024. Jinx rose to fame on RuPaul's Drag Race Season 5 in 2013 and came back to do it all again in Drag Race All-Stars Season 7 in 2022, where she was crowned Queen of All Queens, winning the competition against all previous winners. In January of last year, Jinx made her highly anticipated Broadway debut as Matron Mama Morton in Broadway's longest-running musical, Chicago, and I am still kicking myself that I missed her. Her 10-week run broke box office records, achieving the highest-selling non-holiday week in the show's 26-year history. She has voiced cartoon characters. She has appeared on CBS cop dramas. She's a freaking villain on Doctor Who. Like, literally can do absolutely everything, including riding a horse, which I found out a few weeks ago when she came over to my house to ride some horses. I'm gonna let the Queen of All Queens speak for herself. Here is Jinx Monsoon. Hi, Jinx Monsoon. Welcome to Head on Fire.
Hi, darling. It's nice to see you again.
I so rarely get to talk to people that I've met in person, so this is such a treat. I actually get to have a conversation with somebody that knows where I am.
It's always nice when you get to speak with someone in physical space, since that doesn't happen all the time these days.
First of all, I love your background. It's very witchy wherever
it's
you
my
are.
Office.
This is a very magical space.
This is, well, you can see some awards up here, and then there's fan art up there. Oh, I'm talking away from the microphone. But anyway, there's some awards, some fan art, and then there's some witchy ingredients here because I don't have enough room up in my bedroom and on my altar for everything. And then if I turn a little bit this way, these are some of my, like, these are not drag clothes because all the drag clothes are in the drag room, but these are like my suits for out of drag, but needing to look professional. And then a treadmill that has no, it's just the treadmill part because I want to do numbers where I'm like in constant walking. I haven't figured out what to do with it yet. I also thought I could just set it up in front of the TV and just be like, I've always wanted a treadmill without all the bells and whistles.
I roll it out to the kitchen and I'll watch TV and I put my little treadmill on. Okay, so for the three people who are going to listen to this show who do not know who you are, tell people who you are and what it is that you do.
Well, first and foremost, I consider myself a drag queen and an actor. And those two things go hand in hand because basically whenever I'm acting, there's some element of drag in there and vice versa. But people most know me as the one and only two-time winner of RuPaul's Drag Race. I won Season 5, and then a decade later, I won All-Stars 7. And then most recently, I've added some Broadway and TV credits to my resume. So I'm having a
big
good time right
too.
Now.
So I am so excited to talk to you. It's always fabulous circumstances to get to speak with you, but I also, unfortunately, it feels like terrible circumstances to speak with you because the last year, especially, but the last few years, drag as an art form has been under very serious attack in this country. So I wanted to kind of start off with a little bit of a conversation of drag, of how drag has changed since you got into it. So how did you get your start in drag?
Well, I grew up in Portland, Oregon, which is where I live once more. That's where I am right now. I was a very lucky young queer person because I had a family who allowed me to be queer. I say allowed, but you know what I mean. Like, I had a family who was supportive of me no matter mm-hmm. what, and who was supportive of me when I started doing drag. And I was lucky enough to live in a place that had resources and places for queer youth to get together and put on underage drag shows. We also had it was a Portland institution for over 30 years, but it had many names. It was known as the City back in the day, and then it was like Misfits, and then it was Club Z, and then it was The Escape. But it was an all-ages queer dance club that was open Friday That's through amazing. Sunday. And in the 80s, it was where everyone went gay, straight, queer, whatever, because it was where you could go if you were under 21. And so it had this mm-hmm. amazing reputation. And my mom even went there. And so starting at like 15, I had my after school job was drag queen on the weekends. You know?
That's incredible. Oh, yeah. Gosh.
So
I practically came into the world a drag queen.
I started very early. I've been doing it for like 21 or 22 years now. So that's how I started drag. And I didn't really become a polished drag queen in the general sense of the word. I was always very adamantly like, I kind of wanted to look cuckoo bananas, right? But then I go on Drag Race season 5 and RuPaul encourages me to embrace my glam side. And then ever since then, the rest is kind of herstory, as they say. You know, I kind of really settled into exactly who I was as Jinx mm-hmm. Monsoon, the character, and who I was Jinx Monsoon, the artist. And then flash forward 10 years, that's where I am now, where I'm working primarily as an actor these days, but I am an actor who plays my roles in drag. And that's essentially what I always wanted to do. And it's exactly what I'm doing. And it's a privilege and a luxury, but goddamn, do I appreciate it.
It's amazing because you've gotten to have like a front seat to how drag has radically transformed in the last few decades. It feels like there was like an arc of transformation pre-Drag Race where drag was evolving at the club scene. And then once Drag Race became a whole thing, there's been an arc of transformation there. And then in the last 10 years, thanks in part to Drag Race, but you know, drag has had an even greater revolution. So from your kind of front seat to that history, how has drag changed since you started?
Well, first of all, how it's changed is I never thought any of this was possible. When I started doing drag, sure. I was certain I had to give up drag when I wanted to be a serious actor. And then as soon as I mm-hmm. started working as an actor, all my roles were me in drag because that was the roles I played well. So it didn't make sense for me to try to leave that behind. But that was like in a very small scale. I was like, okay, in a regional theater scale, I've managed to get like drag. But when I did Drag Race, I was like, there's no way we're going to do the mainstream. I gave up on Broadway dreams, you know, because even though at the time that I did season 5, drag was beginning on that boom that you just mentioned, it was nowhere near what it is now. Now, drag queens mm-hmm. have their own TV shows. Drag queens are on every spectrum of entertainment now. They're in the high fashion world, in the comedy world. There's nothing we can't do. And that scares the fuck out of the conservative right, because we are amassing popular opinion. It's not just that we're amassing influence on culture. It's not just that, you know what it is. It's like, they talk about our influence on the kids and blah, bitty, blah, fuck this and fuck that. And about, you know, the morality of it all. But really what they hate is that we're gaining popular opinion. And that's why they had to demonize us, because with popular opinion, people can vote against their ass backwards laws and bills and legislation that they're trying to impose upon us, like some kind of gender dictatorship. And this is the first time in history I feel like popular opinion has been on the side of the LGBTQ plus community. And that is why they are fighting so very hard. Not to mention the fact that by naming us an enemy, by trying to unify their voters against an enemy, they're distracting away from any flaws that might be glaring on their part. And this whole thing, I always, my best friend Kenny says, I always take it back to the Weimar Republic, but hear me out. All of this happened before, you know, the Weimar Republic was in the 1930s, early 40s, leading up to Hitler's ascension. It was this cultural boom, this queer mecca, this artistic mecca in the middle of Berlin. And it was the first community that the conservative party of that country at that time, it was the queer artist community, was the first community they demonized before they then moved on to other communities. And I'm like sitting here thinking, how could this party that represents a country that supposedly is anti-fascist all the way, they're using things out of the playbook of a historically famous fascist. And I was like, how could they even presume they're going to get away with it? And I realized, if they win, they don't have to answer for what they've done. If they win, they don't have to. Exactly. So we have to do everything we can to make sure they don't win in this moment, because if they do, they're just going to make it look like what they did was save America, like they said. You know, they're not going to jot down the fucking pain and suffering they caused in this false ambition to try to get us back to an idealistic time that never actually existed.
You know, what I find so strange about this demonization of drag, of queer folks in general, but very specifically of drag and the trans community in the last few years, is I grew up in a really rural area of the country in East Texas, you know, very, very tiny town. But I remember going to gay bars and seeing some of the church ladies there, you know, putting dollars in drag queens' pockets and, you know, really having a good time. And it seemed like drag was this kind of safe bridge, because it was, I don't know, it made a lot of those kinds of conservative folks remember, you know, those when little boys were like 5 years old and they were throwing on the boa and their mama's heels and ha ha ha. I mean, it just felt like a safe way to interact with the queer community. It was a safe introduction. And it's so strange to me to see the evolution of drag as this safe gateway into the queer community, as this welcome, open arm, come on, let's have a good time. You know, I'm just a person in a funny dress. Yeah, it's the funny, welcoming thing that we can all enjoy. It's an entertainment act. It's there to entertain. Into, oh my gosh, if you put on a wig, you are automatically coming after my kids. And that's so strange to me, because that's dynamic was never extant in any of the people that I ever saw. I saw church ladies, all sorts of very, very, very conservative people that still came to drag shows because that was the safe entryway. And even that now is demonized, is now seen as the, oh, they're going to come for your kids. Just look, they're at libraries reading stories to them. Look at all of this horrible indoctrination.
Yeah. I think the key element there is they chose kids as the
It's always
crusade.
Kids.
Yeah, it's always
kids.
We have an innate human instinct to protect our young. Okay? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't have any kids. I don't think I want any kids anymore. I did at one point, but I'm changing my mind. But anyway, the point is, I still care what happens to innocent young children, right? Like, yeah. What's the most deplorable acts you can think of? It's things that harm the innocent mm-hmm. amongst us. And who's more mm-hmm. innocent than the young? You know, like, we have a human instinct to protect that. So because there is this trope, and we all know that tropes can begin a billion different ways, but like, you know, at this point, a trope, like something that was like a trope at one point, has become this big propaganda machine, like preying upon our fear of children being harmed. And that's like the trope I'm speaking of is, well, think of all the times that we leave kids alone with adults and think they're safe mm-hmm. because they're all the same gender. Well, if that adult mm-hmm. is queer, do we now, like, we now assume that those kids aren't safe because there has been this trope conditioned into us that queer people just can't help themselves but harm a kid, which I don't know where the trope began, because statistically, that's not true. Historically, that's not true. So I don't know where this propaganda began, but because it is something so ingrained in our culture, it is their, like, it's their first and last attack at us, you know? And Matt Bernstein, who's a wonderful influencer online, who's constantly putting out information to help us put all of this shit into context. This is just play for play what they did against queer people in the 70s and 80s. Like all of this against trans people and drag queens. It's like we've gotten to this point where we as a society have accepted that like gay men and women exist, but they fit into our binary and our heteronormative cultural norms now in a way that we can accept. So we can't mm-hmm. come for the queers anymore. We got to find a new target. It's the trans people and the drag queens, but the propaganda is all the exact same. None of it is new. None of it is revolutionary. It's all the same lies they've used before. And in that, while it's despicable and deplorable that they would play upon our sense to protect innocent young kids, the good news about this is they did it before and it didn't work. So it's mm-hmm. not going to work this time. And popular opinion is on our side even more than it was in the 70s and the 80s. And that, though I walk around with rage every day because of what I see happening in the world, I do remind myself two things. Fascists are incredibly stupid, and this hasn't worked before and it won't work now. I'm just so goddamn sick of doing this fight. It's been my whole life. And as a drag queen, I have had a front seat for it. So as a trans person, I have had a front seat for it. And I'm goddamn tired. I'm sorry how much I've been swearing. I woke up in a cussy mood today.
When you're assigned male at birth, putting a dress on is an inherently dangerous activity.
It's inherently political.
It is inherently political. It's inherently dangerous. I'm wondering, I'm sure there's been waves of trepidation in your life, of feeling more and less safe. How are you feeling these days about going out in public and performing?
Well, for the most part, I feel pretty all right because I am very lucky that I live in a place like Portland,
Most of my work is in safe haven cities, the cities that we as queer people flock to because we're safe there.
though, you know, there some of those cities, we were not quite as safe as we thought we were. I mean, think of what just happened in Seattle this past weekend with two gay bars getting raided by police on the auspices of...
Seattle has been on this interesting trajectory for a while. Like I mentioned, I live in Portland again. I had lived in Seattle for 14 years. And here's the difference between the two cities. Both cities have been gentrified to certain extents. Portland has fought gentrification every step of the way and has like held it at bay as much as it can, whereas Seattle turned around, bent over, and said, "Take me, Jeff Bezos. Just do whatever you want with me." And it's hard to see a place that was once so queer friendly and at the forefront of queer safety and progressive laws. Now it's like, what the hell is happening to even that city? And I hate to sound like every other person my age, but it all comes back to capitalism, right? Like,
that's true.
It all comes back to the ruling class if they are the slightest bit inconvenienced, you know, like screw anyone else in their way. And that's what's happening to the queer community in Seattle, is the neighborhood that is being gentrified the most to make it comfortable for the Amazon employees migrating to Seattle, either the bridge and tunnel people or the people who are coming from the people who are coming from outside of Seattle to work there. They are trying to now make that area more comfortable to those people. And that area was previously the queer neighborhood. So all of the queer establishments of Seattle have been under attack for some time and have been systematically edged out in ways like you're describing. There was a raid in Seattle on queer bars, like a raid.
Yeah.
Like the and kind of there. Raids we
they were
talked
there because
about
allegedly there were minors
Stonewall.
That once again were using kids as shields. So allegedly there were minors. And then when the task force shows up, that's supposed to be there to find controlled substances and alcohol and all of that. When they show up and they find, hey, there's no minors partaking of controlled substances or alcohol, there's no minors here at all, they should have left. And instead they walked around and took pictures of men in various states of undress and are threatening to release those to the public. And they gave citations for like dress code. Like, oh, you're
exactly.
not dressed. They
at
were shirtless.
Men.
I'm like, what?
It is that
you're there
the,
for controlled substances. You're
the
there because you were supposed to investigate controlled substances, but you're
to decide their dress code. You know, like it's asinine. It's insidious. It's like, okay, first of all,
and like you said, it's happened before.
Exactly. And it's so obvious what it is. The thing that flabbergasts me is that when I grew up in the 90s, there was this illusion of decorum with our politicians. They might have been horrible fucking people, but as soon as we found them out to be a liar, as soon as we found them out to be doing something that we considered morally corrupt, that was it for them, right? That was a career ruiner. Nowadays, politicians spew whatever toxic, filthy lies. People call them out on their lies and the destruction they're doing. And they go, oh, well. And then everyone moves on and that politician keeps their job and everyone just, because we are reaching, I don't know. I never want to, politics I only know so much about, but if it, like everyone's saying it, we're reaching cult status. Because when a person can do the things that Donald Trump has done and we're still considering him a candidate for president. And I know it's not all of America, but it's enough of America that he's still running. A convicted rapist. It's cult status when a person can do those kind of things and you're willing to overlook it. And the reason why is because there are that many people still motivated by hate in this country because we've let racism and bigotry and misogyny and gynophobia, we've let this go on for, we've let it go unchecked. You know, all the things that we all know but haven't talked about, and now we're talking about it, and it feels like, hello, we're talking about it, but only half the world wants to listen.
You know, so I want to talk to you because we've talked about sort of drag as part of the over culture, but I want to talk about from within the queer community as well. Have you seen a change of acceptance of drag from within the queer community? Because I recall a time, you know, talking about growing up in, you know, rural East Texas and going to gay bars where, you know, drag performers were loved while they were on stage, but had a hard time being seen as people off stage. You know, I've talked to queens over the years who said that they had a problem dating, even making friends due to rampant internalized homophobia and misogyny by cis gay men. Has that changed? Has that improved? You know, that's a side of the community. We all love drag queens, but I think that we either forget or gloss over the fact that there's still quite a lot of internalized misogyny existent inside of the community aimed at drag and those who perform.
Yeah. So the short answer is yes, it's better. It's also at a place that I never expected in my lifetime because you're talking to like a, let's see, when did Grindr get invented? I must have been in my early 20s, mid 20s. I think I started using it before Drag Race. Who knows? The point is, it's like over a decade of using Grindr. I used to be open messages that were just so horrible, full of such discouraging, hateful things to me because I was effeminate. Now, Grindr is where I'm like batting away trans amorous guys, men who are attracted to me for my femininity. Sometimes they're fetishes. Sometimes they're legitimately trans amorous. But here's the flip side of it is a lot of them are DL. And if you're a user of Grindr, you know what DL stands for. It's short for denial. And what I'm dealing with now is like people who are not bothered by my femininity, actually who are really into it, but who are not at a place where they're willing to have the world know that, you know, there's a lot of guys who want to have their cake, but don't want to get any frosting on their face because they're afraid of what people will say about the frosting. And that's where we're kind of at this tricky place where if you're visibly queer, you get the worst of it. And if you are someone who has passing privilege, if you can pass as cisnormative, heteronormative, if you can pass as straight, you know, like lots of people aren't willing to give up those privileges quite yet, even though they're willing to explore that side of themselves. So it's a funny, interesting time, but my work is for the queer community. And that includes, you know, people who might have their reasons for not being able to come out. But like, don't be surprised if I'm not going to have sex with a blank profile, you know? I need some courtesies here.
Speaking of your work inside of the community, you very famously, especially there was a Run One Runway on your All-Stars season where you came out and it was this lovely tribute to all witches everywhere. And you had the dress with the burning flames and everything. It was fabulous. So I did want to know, just from a very spiritual perspective, drag queens almost seem to fit like the role of priestesses inside of the community. They carry our history. They educate the youth. Sometimes they pick up bricks. They honor the dead. They organize community. Does that aspect of drag resonate with you? That seems to be, from my perspective and my understanding of queer history, the most consistent aspect of drag is as this like community pillar, almost spiritual aspect.
Well, you know, I think with most things in life, you get out of it what you put into it. So if you embrace that aspect, resonates with me. Yes, because I am a practicing witch and I love the ability to share with people the things that have helped me in my life, if that might help them in their life. You know, I think of all of the people who have had an influence on me just by them being candid, just by them sharing their own struggles. And then people have told me that by being candid in my life with my gender journey, with my journey as an alcoholic who's now almost 5 years sober, you know, my mental health journey. I've been very candid about all of these things, and it's a wonderful added bonus to my job that I can help effect change within my community by just living my life loudly and unapologetically. It's not why I started doing drag. I started doing drag because I'm a performer and I love every chance I can possibly get to get on stage. But yes, you're absolutely right. Like, our community doesn't have a long-standing written history, but we have an oral history through drag that has been in existence since the birth of our community. And I like to think, like, drag queens in particular, we keep moments of our culture alive for future generations. You know, like, many drag queens, whether they are expressing moments of our culture that are contemporary and rooted in right now, or things from our past, whether we are teaching the younger generation about the icons and the divas that inspired us so that they can live on, or we're just like telling them about queer history, you know? Drag queens are kind of like the living books at the end of Fahrenheit 451, you know, our books keep getting burned or banned these days. So we have to share our oral history to make sure that our community stays educated and informed. Because, like,
do you think that younger queens are as invested in carrying that history as you know, older queens are?
Who knows? I don't know. I know some that are and some that aren't, you know, and the things they're going to be invested in, younger queens are going to be invested in different things. But that's, again, why I'm still here and why there's queen. I mean, we lost so many of our elders to an epidemic that killed off many in our community. And that's a huge tragedy. But there are elders in our community and they do speak out on everything. I can think of Alexandra Billings. Follow her if you don't already. Follow.
I do. We've gotten to have a few interactions. What a marvelous person.
Yeah. And then Marty. Gosh, why can't I remember her full handle right now? I want to say it's Marty Pants. But she is a trans elder that I follow who is so candid with her experience. I'm so sorry I can't remember her handle right now, but I know her name's Marty. And she is a 62-year-old trans woman who has just shared so many, like, you just don't know what it was like before where we are now. And for years, I've seen the elders in our community say that the younger people don't appreciate what they have. Wait until people try to take it away. Well, the day is upon us. And yeah. I hope the younger generation sees why we have been lecturing them and torturing them with queer history, because
if I'm a 19-20-year-old queen, then I grew up never really knowing in my formative years a world in which gay marriage wasn't legal. You know, I mean, it was legalized 9 years ago this year. And I just think, you know, if I'm 19, 20, I probably can't really remember a time when queer people couldn't get married. So it's it's a lot, I think, for I mean, that's a very lengthy period of time to feel like you didn't, you know, to feel like you could be complacent. So it's for good or for ill, right? Older generations struggle and suffer and fight so that the hope is that younger generations don't have to fight as much. So I guess there's, you know, there's a two-edged sword, but that lack of fighting does sometimes lead to a lack of appreciation for what you have. So right. I guess there's,
well,
you know, good and bad with that.
If you think about how, if you think about, okay, the American school system, we are taught what the government thinks is important for us to know, right? And a big part of that is our battle for independence. That is ingrained in us. That is conditioned in us because according to the American government, that is a very, very important part of our history, right? Okay. So because we aren't taught queer history in school, we don't have those things that every single one of us have been taught because of its importance. Like, I'm lucky, like I said, to have grown up in Portland, where as soon as I came out, I was surrounded by queer peers and queer elders who taught me everything I needed to know. And nowadays, I say I came out at 15 and, you know, I'm sure young people don't see that as a huge thing. But it used to be when I said I came out at 15, people would go,
oh, that was That
most
was groundbreaking,
the time,
revolutionary.
If you came out in high school, it was because you were outed. And most people waited for college or until after college, which created the phenomenon of the queer second adolescence.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Suddenly you're acting like a teenager and you're 32.
Yeah, exactly. So, but like, yeah, it's amazing what a decade can do because a decade is all it takes for us to forget that there was a time before queer marriage equality, you know? And I remember that being such a big thing in my family. Like,
oh, yeah.
You know, like, we understand and we support you, but it breaks our heart that you'll never be able to get married. And then I remember a conversation with my grandmother because I was like, she saying, I just feel like we should be allowed to get married. And then she said, well, if a civil union is the same thing, why does it matter to call it marriage? And I said, because it shouldn't have a different name. Like, forget that it's not the same thing. Forget that, like, you know, if you look back, it was not the same equal rights. But my whole thing is we live in this country where it boasts freedom and equality as a prerequisite for every citizen. Every citizen, you're a citizen of America, you are offered equal treatment as a baseline. However, none of us have ever been given that ever, unless you are part of that small percentile that America's actually set up for. And I'm just unable to live in that farce anymore. Like, I'm unable to keep pretending like we're treated like equal citizens, because if we were, these rights that the conservative right are trying to strip away from us wouldn't even be on the table. We wouldn't even be having this discussion. We wouldn't need to defend ourselves against lies because we are American citizens who should, just as a baseline, have these freedoms and equalities already.
I want to talk about you.
Okay.
What's it like to break down barriers, Jinx Monsoon? Because like you said at the top, you are a Broadway star. You're a Doctor Who villain. You're a singer. You're a songwriter. You're all sorts of things. What's it like to walk into rooms where being a drag queen is now a boon, where it might have been a detriment before? What's it like to be breaking down all of these barriers?
Well, I mean, it's wonderful, of course. When I won season five, I was so fixated on the moving forward of this industry. Uh-huh. I was so fixated on what to do next. What barrier am I going to break down next? Like, how am I going to get everyone taught? What's going to be my next Norma Rae moment? You know, I was so fixated on that. And I realized that I was focused on the kind of like the industry aspect of my job. And that's not why I started doing this. And I think I said earlier, you know, like I got into this because I'm a performer and all I want is more stage time. And so honestly, everything you just said, I'm not thinking about that day to day. I'm thinking about how can I be part of the solution and not part of the problem. That's like what I ask myself with all the work that I do, every role that I accept, everything that I do for the public. I first ask myself, is this part of the solution or part of the problem? Or at least I try to. I goddamn try to. And so that's my only overarching intention other than being a good performer. And I have stopped putting pressure on thinking of like what's next and how it feels to do this or that or blah. Stop putting my focus on the accolades and just really zeroed in on do the work that makes me happy, that feels like it's part of the solution and not part of the problem, and stay true to why I started doing this in the first place, which is to be an effective performer. And through being an effective performer, through being a candid, outspoken, public person who's an effective performer, I will be doing the work that you mentioned by just doing my job well.
What's next?
I hope more of the same, honestly. I just want more of what I got to do, everything I've ever wanted to do. And people keep asking like, so what do you want to do now? And I'm like, I don't know yet. So I want to do more of the same. Right? Like I am having a really great time. So anytime Broadway calls, I'm answering. Anytime any film
is
or
there
TV,
a role? Is there a Broadway role that is either already in the canon that you want to try a revival of, or is there?
Sure.
Or do you want to do something new? Would you write a new show?
I've been very, you know, I had a wonderful time doing Chicago, and that is an older show.
I am so upset I never got to see you. You were even here.
I loved going back to the old school with Chicago. And it's something I think I, a drag queen, have this special ability to do in my performance choices. Because as a drag queen, and maybe me as a performer in particular, a director once told me I have a way of making really big choices look natural. And I think that's because I'm a drag queen. You know, all of my choices are going to be big, but I'm also a trained actor. So I know how to like make it live in the world of the character. And so I really enjoy being a character actor. I'm not worried one bit about being typecast because I think I have a lot that I can bring to these iconic roles that we've seen. I feel like I have a lot to bring in the way of like honoring the old school, honoring like the past, but in being who I am playing the role, it's a contemporary take on the character. So I just want to keep doing that in film, TV, on stage. And a dream role. Oh, you said dream role. Oh, sorry. Love to just answer things the way I feel like answering them. But okay, so 10-year plan. I want to be in the next revival of Sweeney Todd. I want to originate a performance of Mrs. Lovett, or like, you know, be
See,
the one.
I was going to go with an Angela Lansbury role for you as well.
You were going to say Maine, right?
I almost said Maine, but actually, I think I want you on the big screen in a remake of Bedknobs and Broomsticks. Really bad.
That's pretty funny. I love
really
that.
Bad. Want you in Bedknobs and Broomsticks?
Racoides, Trachorum Satis D. I remember that. I loved that movie, but.
Who didn't?
Here's my realistic, like, in the near future. I would love to get a crack at the MC because cabaret, the West End performance is coming to Broadway. And my friend Mason Alexander Park got to play the role on the West End. I hope more than anything they get to play the role on Broadway as well after Eddie Redmayne done getting his rocks off with it. I hope Mason gets to play the role again. And then I hope after Mason, I get a crack at it because it's just one of those roles where even though the character is male identified and I'm trans feminine, I still want to fucking crack at it because my whole life there have been like three or four freaking roles in classic musical theater that I'm like, as the kooky drag queen, I better get to play these roles someday. And that's like Frankenfurter, Hedwig. I've gotten to play Hedwig before. I actually played Columbia in Rocky Horror. It was my first production, first professional paid production. Anyway, the MC is one of those characters where if you're like a kooky, offbeat, clearly, obviously queer person, the MC is on your short list of roles you want to try to go for.
Is Shatwa as pretty in person as he seems like he is?
Prettier. So much. And because I'm a first to, like, I'm a slut. I'm a huge slut. I'm attracted to everybody. I don't have a type so much as I just say, if I find you attractive, I find you attractive. That's it. Susie is so attractive to begin with. And then you get to know him as a person, and he's just this gracious, friendly, funny, generous scene partner. Like, you know, just a dream job. Doctor Who was a dream job, period. And then working opposite Shuti and Millie so much, they were just the most generous scene partners. We were always like, if the cameras were rolling, all three of us were giving it all, even if the camera was only filming one of us. And that's not always typical in film and TV. And in that way, it was kind of like bringing theater acting to film in a way that made it, I think, really effective for our performances.
For any Doo fans who might be coming across this in their algorithm because they are furiously searching you, is there any crumbs you can give? Is there any that you can give? And I mean Doctor Who fans, meaning me. Like, hi, can you tell me anything at all?
No. No, I can't.
Who are you?
I'm a villain.
What are you?
I'm a villain with orange hair. But what I can say is this is sure to be the queerest season.
I'm so excited.
Or series, if you're watching from the UK. It's the queerest series of Doctor Who. I mean, that's just like arguably true. You've seen the cast, the roster. Russell T. Davis is a prolific, profoundly talented writer.
Who wouldn't want to get into a Russell T. Davies? Yeah.
He's so incredible. And I say this, you know, and this is part of your queer history, like we were talking about. If you haven't seen It's a Sin, I was reluctant to watch it because I hate watching sad stuff because I cry. Yeah. So much. I ugly cry. But listen, it's compulsory, obligatory viewing if you are a queer person. I believe it's obligatory viewing if you are a human being, because it is so masterfully written. So to be in any production of Russell's is amazing. But what I love about this is the BBC has been very progressive for a long time as far as queer representation. But with this new season with Disney Plus and Doctor Who and the BBC and Russell all working together, it feels like someone said, go ahead, take the gloves off, go as big as you want, because it's gonna be so amazing. I'm so excited.
Exciting. Well, I am so grateful for all of the time that you were able to give me. I know that you are incredibly busy traveling the world. Just came back from New Zealand, of all things. Oh my gosh.
New Zealand.
Your arms are tired.
New Zealand, I gotta tell you, New Zealand and Australia, I just have a lovely time. All the guys are 6'5", look like Thor, and don't wear shoes. It's a paradise. You'd fit
right. Well, I'm very tall. I have that one. I don't know about the rest. So that's very kind.
You're very blonde as well.
That's true. That is true. Well, for folks who would love to get a little bit more of the Jinx Monsoon experience, where can they do that?
Well, You could go to jinxmonsoon.com for everything. Big thing, everyone. It's spelled J-I-N-K-X. I paid extra for the K, so you have to use it. It's very expensive. Ask anyone. No, J-I-N-K-X-M-O-N-S-O-O-N, jinxmonsoon.com. I'm at the Jinx on Instagram. That has my link tree. You can find everything. And then, you know, Jinx Monsoon everywhere else. I think I'm Jinx Monsoon Official on TikTok. The point is, I have all of the social medias, so you can find me anywhere. But really, if you want to see me at my very best, catch me in any live production you can catch me in, whether that be my annual holiday touring production with Ben de la Creme, the Jinx and De La Holiday Show, or if it's one of my original shows with my music partner, Major Scales, or if I get cast as a character in something. I truly believe live entertainment is what I was put on this earth to do. So that's how to see me.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for all of your time.
Thank you, sweetheart. It has been such
a privilege and an honor to get to speak with you again.
Can I say,
thank you so much.
Do you go by Dawn? Do you have a nickname?
Yeah, Dawn. D-O-N. No, just Dawn. It's and
I,
that's
I feel
the
like
thing.
You need,
Dawn,
I feel like
Dawn
you need
isn't
to be
even
like
short
Donnie.
For anything. It's just Dawn. Yeah.
Even, I like
it's not it's not short
Dawn.
For Donovan.
Or Donnie, yeah. Or Donio, or I don't know. You need a little in your Don there.
I know. That's probably why I went by a pseudonym for so many years, because it's just Don. Yeah. It's sad.
Well,
it's so
it doesn't,
sad.
Listen, a name is what you make of it, and you've made plenty of your name, so it was a pleasure to speak
Thank
with you.
Thank you so much. And that is going to do it here for this episode of Head on Fire. My thanks to my guest, Jinx Monsoon. Now listen, just since we recorded this interview a few weeks ago, listen to everything that's been announced. Jinx has also just announced her Carnegie Hall debut with a special concert show taking place on Valentine's Day 2025. Jinx is also coming back as Matron Mama Morton in Chicago on Broadway, June 27th to July 12th. And remember, she's also going to be on Doctor Who this spring. And apparently, her publicist tells me there's going to be a lot of other fun announcements coming up. So definitely go follow Jinx on social media to keep up with all of those. Now, if you want to keep up with this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Consider sharing it with your friends and family on social media. That organic word of mouth is the best way to continue growing this audience so that I can keep bringing fun interviews like this to you. If you like the show, also consider liking it, rating the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and while you're there, leave a review. Reviews help boost the show in the algorithm so that other listeners that listen to the stuff that you listen to know that this show exists. If you hate the ads, and listen, I get it. I'm a listener just like you. I understand how annoying ads can be, but we all have bills to pay, right? Consider joining my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and lots of goodies along the way. Sign up at patreon.com/HeadOnFirePod. Speaking of Head on Fire Pod, that's pretty much how you find me on social media everywhere. I am at Head on Fire Pod on TikTok and Instagram and Threads and all of the everything. If you type that in, you'll probably find me. Also, you can email me contact@HeadOnFirePod.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thanks so much for downloading. I'm going to go, but I'm going to tell you to never stop seeking illumination like a man with his head on fire seeks water. Be well.